Well, would you come with me, please, to Job 23? Job 23. Bibles at the front if you want one. And we're sort of cutting in, obviously, in the middle of the book. Relatively short chapter. I'll just read it. Then Job answered and said, "Even today my complaint is bitter. My hand is listless because of my groaning. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come to his seat. I would present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would know the words which he would answer me and understand what he would say to me. Would he contend with me in his great power? No, but he would take note of me. There the upright could reason with him, and I would be delivered forever from my judge. Look, I go forward, but he's not there, and backward, but I can't perceive him. When he works on the left hand, I cannot behold him. And when he turns to the right hand, I cannot see him. But he knows the way that I take. When he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold. My foot has held fast to his steps. I have kept his way and not turned aside. I have not departed from the commandment of his lips. I have treasured the words of his mouth more than my necessary food. But he is unique, and who can make him change? And whatever his soul desires, that he does. For he performs what is appointed for me, and many such things are with him. Therefore I am terrified at his presence. When I consider this, I am afraid of him. For God made my heart weak, and the Almighty terrifies me, because I was not cut off from the presence of darkness, and he did not hide deep darkness from my face." Okay, well, this is perhaps just taking some of the... We looked at a little few Sundays ago, God of the Corkscrew, and I suppose this chapter we might call Resolving the Paradox. Resolving the paradox. Now, if you remember, Job has lost everything, his wealth, his reputation, his health, and of course he's lost his children. And so the inevitable question comes up, doesn't it? Why? Why has all this happened to Job? And if you remember Job's three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, they know the answer. They tell Job the answer. Job, God punishes the wicked. He rewards the righteous. So if you suffer more than others, it can mean only one thing, Job, that you're a greater sinner than others. It's all very neat and all very wrong. Because in a very real sense, if we know the book of Job, all this is undeserved. Job's the one man in the world who is careful to avoid offending God. If you remember when his sons and daughters go feasting, so it was when the days of feasting had run their course that Job would send and sanctify them. He would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did regularly. He's very concerned to avoid judgment. And of course God himself acknowledges that this is innocent suffering. He speaks to Satan and says, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil? And still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause." So God himself says Job is innocent. So he's suffering not because he's sinned. It's for the complete opposite. He's suffering because he's righteous. He's suffering to prove the devil is a liar. The devil is insinuated, isn't he? Does Job fear God for nothing? The only reason that Job fears you is because you reward him. We'll take away the reward and he'll curse you. So God says, okay. And so Job is suffering to show that the devil is a liar. That accusation is not true. That there is such a thing as disinterested obedience. I don't mean uninterested. I mean disinterested. Job doesn't get any special favors and rewards from God for obeying him. Because Job obeys because he loves the Lord. The Lord's the love of his life. Well, says Job to his friends, okay, I'm a sinner, but not in a way that explains all of this. And if you go through the book, Job won't back down, his friends won't back down. Job stands his ground, this is innocent suffering, and his friends, they become increasingly hostile and aggressive and heated. And you get this sense of Job just needs to be told. And the fact he's not listening in their eyes proves he's a hardened sinner. Because the more he resists what they say, well, it must be because the more he's got such a hard heart. And if you look at chapter 22, later you'll see it all gets very nasty. Well, when it comes to chapter 23, there's a sense in which Job has finished arguing with his friends. What can you say when people aren't listening to you? What can you say to people who condemn you without a shred of evidence? And anyway, Job knows when he comes to chapter 23 that his hope doesn't lie with persuading his friends. He's got bigger fish to fry, if we can put it like that. What really counts is putting his case to God. Not persuading his friends that it's innocent suffering, but putting his case to God. And by the time we get to chapter 23, Job has already spoken like this. He says, I want my day in court. The sense of it is, I want my day in court because I want to, as it were, question, cross-examine God and ask God, what have you got against me? Why have you done this to me? Come on, God, I want you to speak up. I want you to go public. What am I supposed to have done that all this has come to me? And so far, as Job has thrown out that challenge, heaven has been completely silent. There's been no voice from God. As we come to chapter 23, Job becomes more upbeat. I won't say optimistic, but more upbeat. Now we read about the perseverance of Job. Because even though heaven is silent, even though God appears to be pushing Job away, Job keeps coming back. Sometimes God does that. We appear to be deserted. God pushes us away. And the invitation is to keep coming back. Keep coming back, which is what Job does. Well, have a look at to me, and we'll just see what he's saying, all right? So chapter 23 of Job. Then Job answered and said, even today my complaint is bitter, my hand is listless because of my groaning. Okay, when your hand is listless, everything is sort of, oh. It's that sense, oh, no. Oh, here we go again. You know that sort of thing when you just can't seem to make any progress and it's all terrible and miserable and you just think, oh, you just go all floppy, don't you? And sort of, oh, no, here we go again. That's the sense of what he's saying. Okay, verse 3. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come to his seat. If only I could find God. I keep throwing out my challenge. I want my day in court and God isn't answering me. Well, maybe if I could go and find out where he is. Go and find him. And if I could find him, then the matter could be resolved. If he won't come into court, well, maybe I can go to his judgment seat. He won't come to me, I'll go to him. And as it were, force my challenge on him. Verse 4, I would present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I think I've got a very good case. I think I could really argue it well. And show to God this is unfair, unreasonable. I'm an innocent man and I'm suffering. Verse 5, I would know the words which he would answer me and understand what he would say to me. Because if I go to God and I put my case to God, then God is bound to give me an answer, isn't he? I would know what he's all about. God would have to explain what he's doing. Verse 6, would he contend with me in his great power? No, I don't think he would. He'd take note of me. There the upright could reason with him, and I would be delivered forever from my judge. If I could just get access to God, if I could just have a face-to-face meeting, I think he'd listen to me. You know, I don't think he would overwhelm me and terrify me. I think he'd take note of what I have to say. And I think he'd give me justice. And I'd be released from all of this. Now, so far, there's no answer from God. And yet Job is changing. Chapter 23 is more upbeat. If you compare it, say, with chapter 16... In chapter 16, Job cries murder. So 16 verse 12, he He says, I was at ease, but he has shattered me. He also has taken me by my neck and shaken me to pieces. He has set me up for his target. Like God's painted a big target on him. And the archers surround me. He pierces my heart and does not pity. He pours out my gall on the ground. He breaks me with wound upon wound. He runs at me like a warrior. Then verse 18, O earth, do not cover my blood, and let my cry have no resting place. Surely even now my witness is in heaven, and my evidence is on high. Okay, so chapter 16, Job is crying, murder! God has murdered me, and my innocent blood is there to be seen by everybody, that God is my murderer, he's done it. Innocent blood. Pretty strong stuff, isn't it? But coming up to chapter 23, though, he's more upbeat. Job is thinking, well, okay, he's not crying murder now, but if only I could find him. If only I could find him, I think he would listen to me. So he's had no answer from God, and yet he's changing. Now, how do we explain that? No answer from God, yet he's changing his attitude. How do you explain that? Holy Spirit's working within him. Do you want to take that a bit further?
Well, the silence is kind of itself the sanctifying change.
Yes. And what is it that Job keeps doing? You can't stop him doing it. Keeps going back to God. So even though heaven is silent, and even though God is not answering him, he keeps going back all the time, doesn't he? That's real faith. Real faith is not serenity. Real faith is you keep running back to God. And as you say, Pete, the Spirit is working in him, isn't it? So even though he's not aware of God, he is changing. God is shaping him, molding him. The silence is doing something to him. It's another of these paradoxes, isn't it? He's being brought into a deeper experience of God without apparently having met with God. So what's the application for us? How might that encourage us in certain situations? Yeah. There is such a thing sometimes as people talk about spiritual desertion. Okay? When God doesn't answer us, apparently, when God ignores us, when we're in terrible, terrible times, and we're crying to God, and God is not... apparently he's not listening. He's ignored us. There's no answer. Now, in those situations, what's the danger that we would do? I mean, desperate straits, no answer from God. What's the danger? We back away, yeah? We say, God's not hearing me. So I walk out the door, switch off the lights, and go. Job isn't doing that, though, is he? He keeps going back to God. Even though God is apparently ignoring him, he keeps going back to God. And in going back to God, he's changing. So, the application is, isn't it, is that when trials come, and God apparently is nowhere to be found, even before I have a meeting with God apparently, even before I find God, there is nevertheless something that God is doing in me. And God is changing me. And God is shaping me. It's not just that there's nowhere else to go. It's not just that he's the only God there is, so I can't go anywhere else. It is as I go to him, the very practice of going back to God and refusing to let go, that actually is changing me. It's consuming the dross and purifying the gold. All right, so take heart, brothers and sisters. You may find situations where you're under great trial, great distress. You've cried to God and God has done nothing, apparently. And you feel you're just treading water. You feel nothing is going on. And you'll have a real temptation just to leave it, to walk away, to say, God's let me down. No. Do what Job did. That's why he talks about the perseverance or the patience of Job. Keep throwing yourself back into God's arms. And you'll find, even as you do so, even before you've had an answer, something will happen in you. Okay? But let's go on. Let's look at Job's paradox. Verse 3, oh, that I knew where I might find him. But that's the problem, isn't it? Where is he? Look at verse 8. Look, I go forward, but he's not there. I'm backward, but I can't perceive him. I'm going this way, that way. I don't know where God is. You know, where am I supposed to find him? When he works on the left hand, I can't behold him. And when he turns to the right hand, I can't see him. So Job is saying, my case is irrefutable. This is innocent suffering. I could prove my case. I could win my case. The problem is I can't find God to press my case. If only I could put him on the spot. If only I knew where I might find him. But if I can't see him, I know that he sees me. Verse 10. But he knows the way that I take. And if he did try me, I know that he'd find that I was innocent. That's the sense of the second part of verse 10. When he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold. I don't think he's really having sort of great theological thoughts there about how his faith is going to be tested and he's going to become more, you know. I think it's more a case if God actually put me to the test, he'd prove that I would show that I was innocent. And then verse 11. My foot has held fast to his steps, and I have kept his way and not turned aside. I have not departed from the commandment of his lips. I have treasured the words of his mouth more than my necessary food. I know that God would find me innocent because I love his ways and I love his word. And that would be obvious. He'd see that. Oh, that I knew where I might find him. If I could just get to him and present the case, then I know it all would be well. But I can't because I can't find him. Then we go to verse 13. Okay, something now shifts in what Job says. But he is unique, and who can make him change? And whatever his soul desires, that he does. He's not quite so upbeat at this stage. He's saying, there's no one like God. As far as I can see, God's condemned me. Get to God, I could make my case and maybe he'd change his mind. But the problem is when it comes to God, there's no court of appeal. At the end of the day, because he's God, he'll do whatever he wants to do. So I'm not sure I can change his mind. Verse 14, for he performs what is appointed for me, and many such things are with him. Never mind me being able to present my arguments to God, I think he's already made up his mind. And maybe things will get worse. He performs. What's happening to me is what's appointed for me. He's already appointed all this. He's chosen this beforehand, what's going to happen to me. And for all I know, there are other things that are going to come along as well. He's saying that God is incomprehensible. God is sovereign. I want to argue with God, but I don't think I can argue with God. What will be, que sera, sera. God's made up his mind about me. What can I do to change his mind? He's God. I'm only a man. Then verse 15. Therefore, I am terrified at his presence. When I consider this, I am afraid of him. For God made my heart weak, and the Almighty terrifies me. Before such a God, I'm helpless and terrified. Because I was not cut off from the presence of darkness, and he did not hide deep darkness from my face. I feel that I'm just walking in the dark. Never mind light at the end of the tunnel. I can't even see where to put my foot. God really is God. He's the king. He does whatever he pleases. He's arbitrary. He is incomprehensible. He's transcendent. So maybe even if I did find him and put my case to him, it would change nothing. Because he's God and chooses to do as he pleases. So do you feel Job's struggle? Do you see Job's paradox? He wants a face-to-face meeting where it will all be sorted out. Oh, that I knew where I might find him. And yet if he meets with God, what will be the experience? I want a face-to-face meeting with God, but if I meet with God, what will happen to me? Look at verse 15. He'll be terrified, yeah, because he's God. I want to meet with God to argue my case, but if I do meet with God, I'll be terrified, because he's God. Okay? He wants the Lord on his side, doesn't he? Verse 7. There the upright could reason with him, and I would be delivered forever from my judge. And yet, the Lord's already made up his mind. He's already decreed all that will take place. He'll do what he will do. Verse 13, but he is unique, and who can make him change? And whatever his soul does, say, whatever his soul desires, that he does. So do you see the paradox? Okay? Let's spell it out. Okay, paradox. He wants a face-to-face meeting, but if he has a face-to-face meeting, what will happen to him? He'll be terrified, yeah? Because God is God. He wants to argue his point. He feels he's got really convincing arguments. But then when he goes before God, what's it that's so troubling him? God made up his mind, isn't he? You can't change God's mind. The reason this is happening to me in the first place is because God's chosen that it should happen to me in the first place. So you can't change God's mind. He's God, isn't he? God's decided everything. God's in charge. How can you change God's mind? All right? How can I put this? He won't. Change his mind. Okay? It's a paradox, isn't it? A face-to-face meeting, but I'd be terrified. A face-to-face meeting to change God's mind, but he's already made up his mind. If I could only meet with him, if only he'd take my side. But the problem is he's God. He's God. And God is sovereign and terrifying and transcendent and incomprehensible and does whatever he wants to do because he's God, he's the great king. So do you follow the paradox? Yeah? All right, okay. Job's got a problem. How is the paradox resolved? The answer's not in Job 23. How is the paradox resolved? What's Job drawn for us? Yeah, sorry, was that, who said that? Who said that? Was you, John? Yeah, do you want to just say it again? Yes. Yes, he exactly. What Job has done is a relationship with God without a mediator, isn't it? Without Christ. It's Job is saying, look, I've got a Christ-shaped hole here. But of course he doesn't know Christ, so he can't fill the hole. He's saying, there's a problem. How do you resolve the problem? And we come along and say, well, actually, the problem is resolved in Jesus Christ, isn't it? Just some little illustrations. Sorry, Luke 5. Just turn with me to Luke 5. Okay, Luke 5. So I say, Job leaves a Christ-shaped hole, which only Christ can fill. Now, Luke 5, Jesus has been sitting in Simon Peter's boat, teaching from the shore. He then says to Simon Peter, launch out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch. Simon starts arguing with him, Master, we toiled all night and caught nothing. Nevertheless, at your word, I'll let down the net. When they'd done this, they caught a great number of fish and their net was breaking. So they signaled to their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And they came and filled both the boats so they began to sink. When Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees saying, depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord. For he and all who were with him were astonished at the catch of fish which they had taken. And then verse 10, Jesus said to Simon, do not be afraid. From now on, you will catch men. How does that episode resolve this paradox? What do you see in that episode? You see two things going on. He's face to face with God, and he's terrified, right? But what does God say to him?
Well, I was going to say the only argument he can make is go away.
Exactly. But then, what does Jesus say to him?
Don't be afraid.
Don't be afraid. And what's the invitation he says to him? Verse 10. He says, "Don't be afraid." Exactly. And then,
"I'm going to change you."
I'm going to change you. Yeah. You stay with me. You stay with me. So they have the paradox resolved, don't you? He has a face-to-face meeting, Peter, and he's terrified because he realizes he's with God. Okay? But he realizes that God is on his side. God is with him, not against him. Don't be afraid. I'm with you. You come with me. I'll make you fishers of men. Okay? And then you can do this all over the New Testament. I'm just plucking a couple of examples. Matthew 17. Get the same sense as well. Okay, Matthew 17. It's the Mount of Transfiguration. Okay. Now, after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, led them up on a high mountain by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as light. Then verse 5, this is while Peter's still speaking. "Behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them. As suddenly a voice came out of the cloud saying, 'This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear him.' And when the disciples heard it, they fell on their faces and were greatly afraid. But Jesus came and touched them and said, 'Arise, do not be afraid.' And when they had lifted up their eyes, they saw no one but Jesus only." Okay? So can you see the resolving of the paradox there? Christ is revealed as who he is, the Son of God. He shines like the sun. And then they hear the voice from the Father. It's a terrifying experience. But what happens next? Yes. It says, "Don't be afraid." Yes. And you can go through the New Testament again and again, and you'll see this being spelled out. You'll see that God is God. We see the human face of God in Jesus Christ, and he is awesome, overwhelming. You know, when he calms the storm, he talks to the storm like a dog, doesn't he? He says, "Oh, there's down, boy." The storm goes quiet. They're talking about, who can this be? There are times when you have this glorious displays of his deity, and yet you don't have to run away. And he takes your side, and he understands you, and he loves you. Do you see? Do you see the resolving of it? He's God, and yet I'm safe in his presence. He's God, and yet I can be face to face with him and tell him all my heart. He's God, and yet he's on my side and won't let me go. Because he's Emmanuel. He's God with us. So Job's paradox in chapter 23 is he leaves for us a Christ-shaped hole. But then Christ has come. So what comfort is that to us on the 12th of October 2011? Okay, you're going to leave here. You probably think, "Oh, it's been a long day. I'm tired already." And you go home, and you don't know what's going to hit you at home, or what's going to hit you Thursday, or what good's a message like this tonight?
Well, it's because we know that your Redeemer lives. That's the verse from Job itself. Isn't it? I know that my Redeemer lives, and the reaction is that I will myself and depend on the sackcloth and ashes. And when Job gets that meeting with Christ.
Exactly. I can have a face-to-face meeting with God, can't I? In Jesus Christ. All right? And I can argue my point with him and talk it through with him. And I know that he is the one who takes my side, who will never ever let me go, who won't forsake me or abandon me or turn away from me.
Also having the persistence to keep coming back even when it seems like...
Yes. That's right. So can you see Job? You can see how great Job's darkness was, can't you? He had no Christ to go to. I mean, he did, but we're at the dawn of Revelation here. He doesn't see what we see. He doesn't know what we know. And through his experience, God carves out a Christ-shaped hole. Job knows he needs someone to do the mediating for him. He knows he needs he needs to meet with God, and yet for God not to terrify him and send him away. And now we see who that is. Emmanuel, God with us. Jesus Christ.
I think he says it really well in Job 9. At the end there, he talks about heavenly throne God was a mediator between us. 9 to 33, he may lay his hand on us.
Amen. Absolutely. He can put his hand on a man, he can put his hand on God, because he's God and man, can't he? And bring you together. Absolutely. Absolutely. So, Christ is bone of my bone. He's flesh of my flesh. He's my brother. He's my friend. He's my advocate. He takes my side. He's laid down his life for me. He's shed his blood. He's my bridegroom. He's joined himself to his bride in an indissoluble union. Our future and Christ's future are one. We're joined to him. We'll be like him. We'll be wherever he is. And yet, he's also infinitely God. Holy, holy, holy. He's the Alpha and the Omega. And no one can resist his will. Job couldn't put those together. But we can in Christ. We don't worship the Christ of the Middle Ages. You may have seen these sort of icons and tapestries. A sort of terrifying Christ. Sort of a great imperial Christ. Remote. Terrifying. You couldn't go near him. That's why, they went to Mary. Because Mary seemed to be a softer option. An easier person to go to. And Mary would speak on your behalf. We don't worship the Christ of the tapestries. Remote and distant. Neither do we worship the Jesus of the 19th century, where a very sort of weak and sentimental and sort of dewy-eyed Jesus came in. We worship the true Christ. He is infinite, and yet he's also the man of sorrows. He's transcendent, yet he's also a brother. You can meet with your brother face to face, can't you? He's almighty. And yet he knows weakness and temptation. Has experienced all that we will experience, yet without sin. He's the ruler over all. Yet it's not an arbitrary rule, a cold rule. He rules for his church. He rules for his people. All things do work together for good to those who love God, who are the called according to his purposes. His hand does perform what is appointed for us, as Job says. Now, Job found it something terrifying, because it's sort of arbitrary. God would just do what he's going to do. But, of course, the hand that performs what he's appointed for us is the nail-pierced hand. He knows our needs, and his ear is open to our groans and our sighs. So when Job asks, "Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come to his seat." The New Testament writers pick it up and says, "Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly. We know where to find him. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Okay. Any final comments before we sing? Thoughts? And doubly, triply so in Job's day, because if you look at Job, they have a very, very hardly any sense of an afterlife, which is why it's all got to balance out in this life. That's what they're concerned to do. That's why Job's friend says, it balances out in this life, because there's no sense of what's going to come afterwards. So his view of the future is very, very dim. All you can say is that God, by his Spirit, because he is a believer, is teaching him. And he sees things that he could see no other way other than by a supernatural revelation. And maybe there's a sense too, isn't there, sometimes where a child of God may have the experience of God. Let me put it like this. When we were converted, did we have a clear understanding of, let's say, justification by faith, the atonement, the whole thing of the cross? We probably didn't, did we? We're probably very unclear about a lot of things. We just knew that I needed saving and that Christ could save me. And we came to Christ, even though I wasn't clear about all sorts of things. And I think, is there a sense of that with Job, maybe? There's a lot of things where he's being taught by the Spirit, doesn't understand things, but in his experience, he does meet with God and knows things and loves things and believes things without actually having the framework and the full understanding that we would have. And it's interesting, isn't it, that, I mean, in fact, Job is probably the oldest book of them all, the time it's speaking of. And it's interesting, isn't it, how Job has all these questions and all these issues. I mean, someone put it like this, Job has 1,000 questions. They all begin with why. When he meets with God, none of them matter. And there's a sense in which Job never gets his answer, but he gets a real meeting with God. And that, because when he comes face to face with who God is, he realizes actually there is a perfect explanation for all of this, but I would need to be God to know it.
And yet, what a terrible thing.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Peter says that trials come along in order to test the reality of a person's faith. Yeah. So in the good times, it's easy to say, I'm a believer, I trust God, I know God. When then troubles come, if my faith is counterfeit, if my faith is bogus, when it's put in the crucible of affliction, because it's counterfeit, it'll all be burnt up. And the person says, oh, if that's what God is like, I'm going. When a believer's put in the same situation, the fire that consumes the dross is the same fire that purifies the gold. And so the believer comes out of the experience more certain of what they believe. They know I can't walk away. It is true. And they have a real experience with God. So sometimes there is a real sense in which troubles and trials are God sent, as Peter says, to separate the false from the true. Because if it's faith that comes from God and it's real faith, I'm going to stop there because we need to go on. We'll carry this on afterwards. Mm. If it's real faith that comes from God, then troubles don't destroy it. Troubles refine it. It's the gold that's purified, and the dross is simply consumed.